The Government Operations and Elections Committee will start. We can't officially come to order. We don't have a quorum, but I'll get started, and perhaps Representative Downey, when we do get a quorum, I'll officially call it to order and approve the minutes, that type of thing, if that's okay. Where do you need to move your bill? State Gov?
Madam Chair, this would move to State Government Finance.
Okay, I will move that House file. I guess I have to wait till I move it officially. So why don't you just start talking about House File 560, and then we'll break in a minute.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This bill allows government agencies across the state to do something that right now is in state law explicitly allowed for the University of Minnesota and for the Metropolitan Council. It is not explicitly excluded from other state agencies, but the fact that it is explicitly allowed for the University of Minnesota and the Metropolitan Council has other state agencies and local units of government questioning whether or not they have the authority to do this on their own. And so this bill attempts to clear that up. And what it allows those entities to do is something called energy forward pricing. And I'll get into a brief introduction of that, and then I have somebody from the University of Minnesota who can explain exactly what they're doing and the benefits of it. But so the bill itself, you'll notice there's a repealer in the bill, and then there's an additional repealer in the amendment. Right now in state law, there's an explicit allowance in state law for the University of Minnesota in statute. There's a specific allowance in state law for the Metropolitan Council, and then there's a generalized statement in state law. And so all we're doing is we're removing the two explicit allowances for those two entities, and we're putting it all into one section of state law that would allow other units of government and state agencies to do what the University of Minnesota and Met Council are doing right now. And so if you want, I can continue, or if you want to move the bill.
Thank you, Representative Downey. We do have a quorum, so the committee will come to order. And see, Representative Nelson, you've been here since the beginning. Have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Madam Chair, yes, I have, and I moved the minutes from the previous meeting.
Okay, Representative Nelson moves the minutes of January 26th. Do we have any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Downey, I will move House File 560 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance. And then you can continue with your bill. Would you like to adopt your amendment to put it in your shape first, the shape you'd like first, or would you like to discuss it more?
Madam Chair, that'd be great if you wouldn't mind moving the amendment as well.
Okay, I will move the A2 amendment. Does anyone want to discuss it before we move it? It looks like there's some changes, but I think Representative Downey can talk about those in a minute. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. To your House file as amended.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So with the brief background that I gave on the general concept of the bill, I will tell folks that we heard it in higher education last year and had a good discussion, and a number of amendments came out of that that I think improve it. Representative Atkins had a suggestion or two, and actually Representative Quam, in discussing the bill before coming to committee here, had a suggestion that all of which are now embraced in the bill as amended. So the real meat of the bill, and then I'll explain the amendment briefly, is found on line 1.13. Right now, governmental entities can participate in kind of upfront purchasing of energy of its various types, and the value of that is that you get budgetary certainty. You know exactly what your energy or fuel costs are going to be over a certain period of time. The challenge with that is you win some and you lose some. If energy prices go down, you've actually overpaid from a budgetary standpoint, and if energy prices go up, you are a winner. A lot of that is by chance. And there is a mechanism that you can use relative to options and futures of energy pricing that allows you the same kind of price certainty, but allows you to actually hedge the market and make sure that you're not paying for those dramatic ups and those dramatic downs. And so the intent here is to just allow energy and fuel purchasers in the public sector the ability to use those kinds of techniques. And again, the Met Council and the University of Minnesota have been doing that very successfully. The amendment that you have before you includes electricity, so that you can also do this with electricity and not just the other fuels. It also, to address a concern that Representative Quam had, strikes a provision that says that every governmental entity has to have their own set of accounts, so that if you wanted to enter into some kind of a shared services agreement as a group of local governments, or if as a local government you want to leverage the county who has the expertise and the tools to do all of this, we're not going to prescribe that every unit of government has to do this on their own and account for it all on their own. They actually could have some kind of a shared service arrangement. I thought that was a good suggestion from Representative Quam. So we struck the language that says that every unit of government has to have their own accounting mechanism. And then importantly, the language that Representative Atkins was getting at, just making sure that we had appropriate controls and that we weren't inducing local, very small buyers of fuel and electricity, or people maybe without the sophistication to do this well. There's a set of controls and an oversight process that's prescribed in subdivision 5 on page 2. So that, I hope, is a reasonably coherent description of the bill. Again, the purpose here is just to allow other units of government to do what the University of Minnesota and Met Council are doing very effectively. And I thought it would be helpful. We have somebody from the University of Minnesota here who can describe how they're doing it and what they're doing and the results before we open it up for questions.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please state your name for the record before you begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Sudbeck. I work in the Office of Investments and Banking at the University of Minnesota, and I work alongside our facilities management folks in undertaking the hedging program we're currently doing at the university. You have in front of you a small number of slides that I'll quickly go through and turn it over to questions that any of the committee members may have. This packet was actually presented earlier, as Representative Downey has indicated, in the Higher Ed Committee. If you look at page 2, you can see that the university facilities, we manage roughly 28 million in gross square footage. That's a combination of athletic facilities, historical buildings, technical buildings, and all the facilities that the university encompasses for classroom and all the activities. On page 3, this is just for the Twin Cities campus. Our fuel breakout for heating for the university is largely natural gas, 70%. With a number of other components, oat hulls. We have a bioreactor, a biofuel capable burner that we have been doing oat hulls, and then oil as well as coal. The oat hull, coal, and oil components have been shrinking over the years simply because of the lower price in natural gas. But natural gas is our primary fuel component. On page 4, you can see where natural gas prices have gone through over the last 13 years. They've peaked out at $14 and also at a low of $2. The main focus of this program is to take out those peaks and valleys and basically ascertain budget certainty, and along with a reduction in the volatility of our overall costs when looking at natural gas. On page 5, the purchasing strategy is made up of a number of components. The goal is to manage, as I said, the risk and price volatility that we experience from both a budgetary perspective and an actual cash flow perspective. The university protocol and purchasing plan is very important. Both those documents govern how we establish guidelines around our purchasing and how we move forward with the plan, and it provides enough structure that it prevents us from getting overly excited about low-cost fuel or high-cost fuel. So I think it provides a really good structure for the plan. The cross-functional team with the university brings in many different aspects. We have folks from facilities management, folks from the finance office, as well as folks from our office, investments and banking, that add a lot of different perspectives and provides a rich discussion when we come into making these decisions. The market expertise in transaction execution is provided by an outside third-party vendor, a fuel services company, and they also bring in additional market perspective and overall market expertise in executing the program. The results of the program are on page 6. You can see that over the last 8 years, we have experienced savings in the program of $27.6 million. That's an average annual savings of a little bit more than $2.9 million. So the program has been working as we have expected and has provided us with a good amount of return. Now I'd like to throw the discussion open for any questions that the committee members may have.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Downey and Sudbeck. First of all, I'm aware. I'm glad you're bringing this forward. A municipality that I am familiar with has been buying gasoline. Doing some locked-in pricing and so on, and saved the city hundreds of thousands of dollars over the last couple of years. And I'm wondering, are they doing this against the law or just absent the law? That's one question I have.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, they are not doing this against the law.
Okay.
There is an ability to do this for fuel today, but they don't have the ability to do it using the options type of strategy that you're hearing from the university. And so what they have done is they have bought ahead, and because fuel prices have gone up recently, they've been winners.
He's been a big winner on that whole deal. The second question, Madam Chair.
Representative Baird.
On the amendment line 1.2, except electricity, I'm curious either to the Representative Downey or Mr. Sudbeck, how you're going to price electricity forward. I'm not familiar with the concept. Can you give us a brief description?
Mr. Sudbeck?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a pricing market, an options market, that we could hedge, or whoever. The university currently does not hedge electrical, but there is that ability. I will say that market is not as deep or as liquid as the natural gas and the oil and other types of markets, but that is available to people who want to do it.
But I'm intrigued. I hope you do well with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have a little history happening here in the GovOps Committee. I wanted to say for the record, I am voting for a Keith Downey bill. I think this is great, and I think it's going to save a lot of money. And I don't know, given some of the hanky-panky with, oil pricing, whether it's the manipulation of the market, the big oil companies, et cetera. And I think we also have some long-term trends, I think, that even come out of the energy industry that indicate, at least for transportation fuels, which I follow and track closely, supply and demand issues, we're going to also see an upward trend. And I'm wondering, Representative Downey, did you factor in some of that? Are you seeing the same kinds of things I'm seeing in terms of really looking at generally an upward trend, at least in transportation fuels, and because of course there's risk if the price goes down, but I just don't see that. I think long term we're looking at an upward projection, or is that kind of consistent with what you've been seeing?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Hornstein, I probably don't follow this as closely as you do. I'm a little more like most consumers. I just see it at the pump and in my bills when I get them every month. But I have done some reading since agreeing to carry this bill. And what's interesting to me is the extent to which energy prices they follow the traditional supply and demand pricing mechanisms, but there is a lot of action in these kind of ancillary markets, or not ancillary, but in the markets that I think drives some of the pricing as well. So if you aren't participating in those markets, as the University of Minnesota is, then maybe you're subject to the whims there you know, anecdotally, as an average person, I'd say I agree with you. You'd see energy prices increasing. But the beauty of this is whether they're increasing or decreasing, the way you participate in the markets allows you to hedge against either an increase or a decline either way.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support the bill. I think it's a great idea. I actually carried, I think, probably the last expansion in 2007 of the same program. So I think it's great. And to be honest, I hadn't even heard of it before then. But I commend you for the bill. I guess the question I have, one is more, well, let me start with the specific one on the bill. Line 2.10 through 2.14, and I'm sorry if I missed it, whether your amendment changed that at all. I don't think so. But is there a local impact note on this, or is one necessary for this bill, you know, the costs of implementing the oversight process?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, I do not have a local impact note. As we go into state government finance, my intuition is that this doesn't have a mandated cost because it's a permissive bill, but you raise a good point. I should probably request a fiscal note and a local government impact note. I'm guessing that they would be zero. The language in 210, 214, Representative Simon, was actually in large part in response to some of Representative Atkins' questions in higher ed, and it also had bipartisan support there, too. So getting bipartisan support in two committees in a row, that's great. But he was concerned that people who really didn't have the experience would be jumping into this, and so we put this kind of set of controls. You could also try and put some kind of a fence around it and say you have to be doing it at a certain volume or something like that, but that constrains them as well if they want to go into a shared services agreement or an MOU joint powers arrangement with somebody else who's got the skills. So we put this language in just to make sure that whoever is doing it on their behalf has the appropriate controls and oversight.
Representative Simon.
Just a quick follow-up, and maybe we could continue this offline, but I'm wondering whether this is something worth doing for other commodities. I don't know whether it is done. Obviously, fuel is kind of front and center, but I remember back when I was involved in this issue that it seemed intriguing to me, and I don't know if you know whether anything has been done with other, you know, commodities or items like this. It's just an intriguing concept.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Sudbeck,
members of the committee, we do not currently. We are exploring whether or not we're going to start doing this with our gasoline expenses with our transportation, our buses and fleet vehicles. We have not gone that far yet. As far as commodities, we would need to break out what are raw commodity inputs for that to be effective under our protocol agreement. We have not done that. We are just sticking with just the larger components of our heating cost, which is natural gas.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, remember seeing previous bills that have gone through regarding the Hennepin County and Met Council, and I am also supporting this bill. And I do like the fact that not just buying and selling, but you're giving them the option. I think that'll help protect people when the market goes down. If they have an option, they don't have to exercise the option. I like that part of the bill, so I too am going to be voting for the bill.
Any other questions or discussion? Senator Downey, did you want to wrap up or
no,
are you good
thank
to
you,
go?
Madam Chair.
Okay, seeing no other discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 560 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Good job, Representative
Downey. Yeah, thank
Downey.
You, Madam Chair, members.
Just keep that in mind, a bipartisan Downey bill.
I thought I was going to cost some support.
Okay, next on the agenda, we have House File 1831, Representative Wardlow.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like me to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
Okay, I will move that House File 1831 be recommended to pass and be referred to Commerce and Regulatory Reform. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. To your bill.
Very good. First thing, there's an amendment. If there would be a motion for this amendment.
So we have the amendment here?
A1 amendment.
Hold on just a second. Okay. Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment? Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. Did you want to speak to the amendment before we voted on it, or is it just technical?
It's not quite technical. It doesn't concern the subject matter jurisdiction, I don't think, of this committee. But
why don't you just describe it quickly, and then
I'll describe
it quickly.
It alters the manner in which judicial review is performed under the bill. Certain determinations under the bill in the original draft go straight to the Court of Appeals. This amendment makes it so that the Office of Administrative Hearings performs those initial appeals of certain determinations or classifications of agency rules.
Okay. Does anybody want to discuss the A1 amendment before we come to a vote on the amendment? Representative Scalzi.
Well, I'm just wondering what happened, what transpired, and why you're doing the A1 amendment.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Madam Chair, this amendment, very simply, I think that the Office of Administrative Hearings, which handles agency matters and rulemaking disputes and things of that nature, is best suited to do a first-level review of classifications of rules by agencies under the bill, and to expand the administrative record if necessary. And then the Court of Appeals, according to the procedures in the current Administrative Procedures Act, could be taken to the Court of Appeals of the administrative law judge's final determination, which would be considered a final determination in a contested case under the amendment.
Okay, we're still on the A1 amendment. I don't know, Representative Simon, if you had a chance to look at it, but we are going to take a vote, I believe, on the A1 amendment, unless you see additional questions. Okay, why don't we go ahead and take a vote. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, House File 1831, is an attempt to address a major problem at the core of growth of the state spending and what I think of as a growing soft tyranny of unelected technocrats, well-meaning bureaucrats, but nonetheless unelected. We have a problem where we have moved, there's a multiplication of both statutes and rules in the state, and there has been over the course of the last 3 decades. We've moved from just, I think, 70 chapters of rules in 1982 to, I couldn't exactly count, but somewhere around 700 or 800 chapters of rules presently. So what happens when you have this multiplication of rules and delegation of legislative authority to unelected civil servants? Well, it undermines the rule of law. It undermines representative democracy. Quick quote from James Madison, Federalist 62. It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they can't be read or so incoherent they can't be understood. And that's the problem that this bill attempts to address. Trying to dial back a little bit rulemaking authority, keep it closer to statutory intent, and make sure that the legislature is accountable for the laws and the rules that are imposed on the people of Minnesota. So the bill does that in a number of ways. First of all, it requires a vote in the legislature, up or down vote, of any rule. This is prospective, and it's also retrospective. I'll get to that in a second. Any rule that meets a certain threshold. And you need to pick a threshold of some sort to determine, you know, what kind of rule should go to the legislature for review. And we all are very much aware of the crisis in our economy, the jobs crisis, and this addresses that as well. So any rule that would impact the economy of the state of Minnesota by $2 million or more, cost $2 million or more for businesses to comply with, or any rule that significantly increases costs or prices for consumers or individual private sector industries or state agencies, local governments, individuals, or private sector industries or enterprises within certain geographic areas of the state, or any rule that would have a significant adverse impact on the competitiveness of private sector Minnesota-based enterprises or on employment or on investment, those rules would be deemed what the bill calls major rules and would need to go, before they take effect, to the legislature for an up or down vote. And the bill specifies the form and the procedure for that as well. It's simply a joint resolution in the form specified, which is basically, be it resolved that the legislature and the House and the Senate approves such and such rule according to this resolution, and that's it. And that resolution would need to be adopted within 20 legislative days of a report from the agency classifying its rule as a major rule or a non-major rule. And no rule may go into effect under this bill until, if it is a major rule, until, first of all, if it's a non-major rule, if an agency says this rule doesn't meet the threshold for a major rule, then they report that to the legislature and the rule goes into effect as per normal procedures under current law. If an agency says this rule does meet the threshold for a major rule, it would have a negative economic impact at the level specified in the bill, then it goes to the legislature for approval and doesn't take effect until a joint resolution of approval is passed by both houses and, of course, because we have the presentment requirement of the Constitution, signed by the governor as well. So it just pulls back a little bit of agency rulemaking authority and makes sure that the legislature has a chance to take a second look at the more significant rulemaking that's being done in terms of affecting jobs in the economy and people trying to pursue their dreams. This has a lot to do with the concept that we are a country and a state that believes in self-government. I think we've moved too far towards vesting and trusting the expertise of unelected persons do a lot of things that individuals used to do themselves. We should trust the expertise of individuals in their own endeavors. And to the extent we don't do that, government should be limited. And in the limited roles the government should have, and they certainly are very important roles for government, the legislature needs to be accountable to the people. And we cannot have increasing multiplication of rules. Now the NFIB, I talked to the NFIB about this bill, and they haven't had time to fully review the bill, but they're very encouraged by the bill, although they can't take an official position yet. But they relayed an anecdote that I thought was very apt. Some time ago, they were talking to their members about rules and that were particularly burdensome. And they found that NFIB members found it difficult to distinguish between rules and laws. Because if you think about it, the impact on businesses is the same for a rule or for a law. You have to follow a rule, you have to follow a law. There are implications for breaking either. And the report came back, and a lot of things that businesses found burdensome were rules, a lot of things that they found burdensome were laws, but they couldn't distinguish between the two. So what does that say about the rule of law in our state? If businesses don't even know if the rules being imposed on them, what's regulating them is a law or a rule, the lines of accountability are blurred. Who do they go to resolve the problem? Do they go to an agency? Do they go to the legislature? And how many of us have been confused trying to figure out the import of some particular statute or some particular set of rules and gone to an agency and got a confusing answer? So, back to the Madison quote, if elected officials can't clearly understand the laws we're voting on and the rules that are put into place under those laws, what exactly are we doing? So this is a big problem, a significant bill, but it goes in the right direction towards limiting the size and scope of government, reducing government spending, returning power and trust to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and making sure that we, as legislators, are accountable for the laws that we impose and the rules that are imposed on the citizens of the state. And I think it will have a positive economic impact. And I'll leave it there. And happy to take questions.
Representative Nelson, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I passed around, had a letter passed around in 2003, I was right, I'm just confused here. Governor Plenty vetoed a bill similar to this, maybe not quite as far-reaching as this one, and also Governor Dayton on April 14th of last year also vetoed a rule and cited Tim Pawlenty, Governor Plenty's objection to this. And just so everybody knows, I passed the letter around. So I think this is an overreaching, I think, of the legislative process. I mean, I'm reading the bill and looking at no judicial review. Are we saying the courts, are we changing our constitution so we don't have that balance that we have in our constitution where we have the legislative branch and the executive branch and the judicial branch? And I think we're overstepping with this bill on the legislative branch and their authority to make rules and try and enforce the rule of the laws that we pass. So I have many objections to this bill, and I think as we go on to the questions, we'll bring that up.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you. This, I forgot to address the judicial review portion of the bill. Now, the bill allows for judicial review in certain limited circumstances. First of all, the bill, and most importantly, the bill allows for judicial review of an agency determination to classify a rule as a non-major rule. That is, to say, when an agency says, this rule does not have a significant adverse economic impact, that can be reviewed upon a petition by any person that would be aggrieved by such rule to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So there's a process to review that. Now, the intent there is to make sure that agencies are careful and pay attention when they're doing this, going through the rulemaking process, and they don't classify things that actually do have significant adverse economic impacts as non-major rules, so they don't have to go through the legislative approval process. I think what this will do ultimately, so that will make sure that either rules are non-major and narrowly tailored and carefully drafted so that they don't impact the economy, or they will be very significant rules that have important policy purposes, and the legislature, if they have economic impacts, will have a chance to take a look at them. Either way, the agency will have carefully drafted the rule. It won't go too far, or it won't go beyond the statutory purpose, and the people will have a little light will be shed on the more major rules because they'll go through the legislative process. So there is judicial review in that sense. And I haven't seen this letter you're referring to, the veto letter, and I don't know to the extent to which those proposals were similar to this proposal.
We'll get you a copy of that letter, Representative Wardlow. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Nelson?
Well, in his presentation, he talked about costs and how much is this going to cost. I mean, reading the bill, every rule that's on statute is going to be reviewed every 2 years. I mean, the cost of our staff and our time, it's what the legislature is going to be tied up with just reviewing all the rules that are out there. And I guess I have concerns about if a rule doesn't get reestablished, say a clean water rule, and because it's null and void because it has significant impact, and I agree that they do have significant impact on employers and businesses in the state. But if I'm harmed because company XYZ pollutes the water that runs down in front of my house that I end up having to drink, and I don't have the ability to go after them because the rules are no longer valid. I guess I have concerns about this bill all the way along and the constitutionality of it. And again, I guess that it's just the whole thing. I think it's a very bad bill, and I think it's a bad way to go. And as both Governor Dayton and Governor Pawlenty in the past have said, I think this is a bad precedent to set. And I believe that when this does get to the governor's desk, it probably will get the same veto letters we have seen before us.
Representative Wardlow.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, thanks for those comments. I disagree. I think it's a good bill. Now, keep in mind that this bill does not automatically delete any rule or nullify any rule. It doesn't do that. All it does is requires agencies to classify their rules as either impacting the economy in a negative way to a certain extent or not. And rules that do have prospective or have, in a two-year period, negatively impacted the economy, those rules go to the legislature for the legislature to take a look, and just those rules. And if the legislature decides that the rule is too costly or the agency has gone beyond the ambit of the statute under which the rule should be promulgated, was promulgated, or finds other good reasons why the rule should not stand, the legislature can then go ahead and vote the rule down. Or the governor could veto the bill, the joint resolution as well. So it gives the governor a little bit of authority that way too. But nothing is automatically canceled. No rule is automatically canceled by this bill. It does require a review of all existing rules by each agency to make that determination about whether there's an economic impact, but that's something agencies already do under the Administrative Procedures Act, 14.127. Legislative approval of rules is already required for rules that impact businesses that have less than 50 full-time employees if the cost of complying with the rule, proposed rule in the first year after rule takes effect, would exceed $25,000. And that, so agencies already have expertise and have the capacity to make these kinds of determinations and are actually required to do so. So it's not that big of a change in that regard, at least. The change that's more significant and I think much needed is simply that rules that have very significant impacts, rules that affect Minnesotans in the pursuit of their dreams and the pursuit of their businesses and trying to improve their lives and build their families, those rules, costly rules, come before us, legislators, so we can pass on them. And then the people have more information and can see who to go to, and we can be held to account if we make the wrong decision. And it's not just in the hand, the process is not solely in the hands of unelected civil servants who are not accountable to the people directly.
Representative Wardlow, could you just clarify on Representative Nelson's question? Are both non-major and major rules under your bill, do both of them sunset, or is it just the major bills would sunset?
Oh.
Could you just clarify that?
Every 2 years under the bill, and I'd be open to suggestions on that time frame, maybe. Maybe it could be lengthened or shortened, lengthened perhaps three. But non-major, all rules would be analyzed every 2 years to determine whether they have had significant economic impacts or are likely to continue having such impacts. So they're reclassified every 2 years. And only rules that are major rules go through the legislative review process. So it's a sunset of all major rules every 2 years, but the classification is reviewed.
So it would just be, it would be bills that have an adverse effect or impact on the private sector economy of 2 million or more would be the ones that would
right.
Could sunset. Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Madam Chair, that's the point I have. Like I said, on page 8, on line 8.28, starting there, it says each major rule shall expire and become of no force in effect. And the example I gave of Clean Water or Clean Air Acts, rules that are out there, that they would become null and void, and if they didn't get reauthorized. And that's right here in the bill. That's the wording of the bill. Each major rule shall expire. To me, that means it goes away. I mean, there may be some other term that the attorneys have, but to me, that means it goes away and shall have no force and effect. So me as a private citizen, I'll have no recourse but to go after, because there's no rule preventing them from doing this. I think this is, again, this part of it and other parts of it, I think are egregious and are a bad and make this a very bad bill.
Sure. Yep. Representative Nelson, I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't all just the bills that have the 2 million. So I just wanted to make sure I understood that correctly. Let's move on to Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I guess I don't quite know where to start, but you had mentioned soft tyranny, and I'm not a James Madison expert, so you got me there. But to legislate a limit on debate on to say that after 2 hours of debate, it shall be in order for any member to move the previous question, that's sort of hard tyranny to me. There's lines in here that are telling the legislators what they must do. This isn't a may. This is a shall. Shall move the previous question. That's pretty scary, but when you look at the purpose, usually the purpose of a bill is for some way to make lives for Minnesotans a little bit better. And I look at the purpose of the bill, and it says, very few aspects of an individual's life are not now touched in one way or another by the long arm of the state. And I think, whoa, this sounds like a debate on the national scale. And maybe this came from a national organization. It sounds like that to me. And also like clearing away unduly burdensome regulatory requirements. In my business, I've got a little business, and granted I fall under the numbers, but and I really respect my colleague, Representative Hornstein, but I'd hate to have him deciding how we're going to dispose of asbestos or R-22 or any of those issues. I mean, I just don't think the legislature has the knowledge. Speaking as a legislator, we just don't have the knowledge. Yep. We have to rely upon people to protect us, and that's what some would call the long arm of the state. I would say that's a good thing for me because I'm being protected. My customers are being protected. This would not make me hire anybody. This would make me just be a little bit afraid of the legislature. To me, it's very scary. It's a scary bill, but that's my comment. I don't have a question for you. It's very scary.
Representative Wardlow?
If I may, thank you, Representative Scalzi, for your comments. I think you're getting right to the heart of the matter, even though I disagree with your comments. They're right on point. The question really is, to what extent is government overreaching? And who does create prosperity in our country? Is it individuals, or does government do it? To what extent should government be involved in protecting people, in various policy areas? Have we gone too far? To what extent should we trust organic institutions and natural associations to protect people and help each other out with certain things? These are all very significant questions, and I think we're kind of coming to a point in our history where we need to really talk about these things. So I really appreciate you raising those points. And I would simply say that, well, first of all, the bill is partly based on a federal act that passed the federal House of Representatives, the RAINS Act, I believe it's called. Now, just in part, and adapted to Minnesota with many changes made, and it doesn't come from any national organization. It doesn't come from any model bill other than the fact that it's in part based on that act, which I think has good policy reasons for it at the federal level. And I adjusted it to fit Minnesota and some of the differences in Minnesota and the state level. I think that oftentimes it is overlooked, the fact that the state regulation is overlooked. And as people look to the federal scene, national level, they look at what's going on there, they forget about how much goes on at the state level and how much regulation there is and how many state statutes impact businesses and the impacts of what the legislature does and state agencies, what they have on people's ability to pursue their dreams and build businesses and on job creators. So the first sentence there about the long arm of the state, that's my writing, and I really think that we need to reassess the extent to which the state should be involved in people's lives and go very carefully through each and every way in which the state is involved in people's lives. But we need to draw a line somewhere because, as you noted, we can't review everything, and certainly some things are best left to agencies, and certainly certain things we don't have the expertise to handle. So for those things that we don't have the expertise to handle, it's either going to be handled in the private sector, or if it's sufficiently significant and there's some reason that the private sector can't handle it or won't do it, then the government needs to do it, and that's where agencies come into play. But if agencies are doing it in a way that they're going beyond the ambit of statutes passed by the people's elected representatives, and it's negatively impacting the economy, then I think that we should have a look at those regulations in particular, and those rules in particular, so that people, so there's some accountability.
Representative Scalzi.
And I just have to add that, you know, I don't know if you own a small business or have ever operated a small business or own a business property or hire people and pay a payroll and provide health insurance. I do all of those things. The state does not impact my business because I can follow the rules that the state has set. The people who impact my business are the people who drive around with tools in the back of their truck that are unlicensed, uninsured, unbonded. The state protects me as a business person. If I lose that protection, I lose my business. So you have to be careful when you talk about the long arm of the state assisting businesses, because it does help businesses, and it keeps the bad guys out, and it protects people. When you talk about people's lives, we need protection for people's lives. If I run my business in a bad way and my people are dealing with natural gas, if I do it in a bad way, we're bad people. The long arm of the state is necessary to require that I'm bonded and that I follow all these rules that I have to follow. It's a good thing, and it's a good thing for my business.
Representative Wardlow, and that confused me a little bit. I'm guessing that the intent isn't to harm businesses. Wouldn't the legislature also look after your business? I mean, I kind of get the impression that it's the agencies that are going to look out for your business, but I would hope that the legislature would also look out for business owners. And before you answer that, I just want to comment that I too have heard some of these concerns and share some of these concerns about agencies and the limits to which they do or do not have. And I personally don't think it's unreasonable to have the legislature look when it's a certain dollar amount. When there's small rules, I can see that, but when it's big, major rules that are being passed without the legislature, who are elected officials, having some ability to look over those rules, that kind of gives me unease. And frankly, I have gotten feedback from many citizens that they feel as though sometimes different agencies have gone above and beyond their power. So I do feel like there, you know, whether or not this is the exact right language, I'm not sure, but I do feel like there is a place for the legislature to kind of look at that. And I had to, Representative Nelson, you brought the letter from Governor Dayton, and I guess I'm not surprised that both Governor Dayton and Governor Pawlenty didn't want any infringements on their power, and I would guess that if I were governor, I would be tempted to write the same type of letter, because you know, I guess that's human nature. But I'll stop for now, Representative Wardlow, if you wanted to get back to Representative Scalzi's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi, I would simply say that the bill is encouraging to the National Federation of Independent Businesses, although they haven't taken a position yet, and it is designed to improve the business climate by improving certainty. Now, because the bill does not automatically cancel any rules, it just adds a little bit of oversight and a little bit of accountability for rules that will have a negative adverse impact on the economy, and encourage agencies to draft their rules in a narrow fashion to make sure that they adhere to the statutory purposes of the statutes they're meant to implement. And that's all. And by creating certainty and having some accountability, it improves the business climate, and we certainly need to improve the business climate in this state.
Representative Hornstein, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's an interesting day. First, I vote for Keith Downey bill, and now I agree with Governor Pawlenty, but I just had a couple of questions. Representative Wardlow, so you in subdivision 4 in section 1 you define a major rule, and I'm wondering if you can quantify you know, maybe over the last couple of years, how many major rules have been propagated by, you know, various executive branch agencies. And maybe even just share with the committee an example of one of those rules.
Senator Wardlow.
So, examples of rules that would
Yeah, that would fit under your title of a major rule in subdivision 4. You know, how many are we talking about? I'm thinking, are we going to have a lot more legislative business, or is it just a couple of them we would want to look at under your bill?
Well, the problem is really, and that we don't know. We don't know, according to the business folks I've spoken with, what rules impact the economy to what extent. But we do know, and there have been many studies, that excessive rulemaking is linked to a poorer business climate. Because if you have the more rules you have, the more agencies you have, the more duplicative rules you have, the broader the rules, the easier it is for there to be selective enforcement of rules. And if you don't know what rules are governing you, and you don't even know if what's governing you is a law or a rule, how can you plan for the expansion of your business? How can you plan your life? How can you say there's a rule of law when you have so many rules that can't be really understood? And that goes back to Madison's quote. So that's really the heart of the problem. Now, there are generally, I can give examples of areas of rulemaking where there are concerns up north with regard to mining. There are certain water quality standards and related rulemaking that may impact new mining businesses. And I know this has been an issue that other representatives have attempted to address in the not-too-distant past. But those are the kinds of things that we're concerned about. And this would be one way to get a little bit of legislative light shined on those areas, you know, a little bit of recourse for the citizens who would be subjected to rulemaking and perhaps weren't involved in these somewhat cumbersome and Byzantine rulemaking process.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hornstein.
Another comment then. So, I mean, it concerns me. We have a 10-page bill before us about major rules, but, I mean, it's hard to know what you're getting at if we can't have an example, if you can't cite an example of a rule that you're concerned about. But you did cite mining for as a general idea, and you know, it would seem to me that, perhaps it's rules related to public health or occupational safety and labor or the environment, for example, that might be the kinds of rules you may be concerned about. And, my concern on that, Madam Chair, is that, you know, we have very vested economic interests that don't like those rules. And so it would be those very interests then that would be lobbying us to address those issues. So, you know, let's cut to the chase here. I mean, we're talking about very large corporate interests with armies of lobbyists and associated PACs and how that is somehow making government more accountable. I think you used that term when you were introducing the bill. I think we have a constitutional system that has separation of powers with an executive branch, a legislature, and a judicial branch. We don't have the corporate branch of government or the lobbying branch of government. And so I think this just goes in the wrong direction in terms of, you know, the principles that you're talking about, which are basic democracy and accountability. And then one last comment, too. You know, my friend Representative Beard has often said, you know, we don't like findings in bills. And I don't know if this, you've taught me, Representative Beard, you've taught me well. I had some findings in the bill, and he, I think, now in retrospect, correctly. So I don't know if Section 7 fits under that. Seems like it's somewhat related. And so I would share Representative Scalzi's concerns about Section 7. But I think this, you know, cutting to the chase, I think this is about some very vested, powerful, you know, economic interests eroding, I think, representative government and accountability as we have under the separation of powers in our Constitution. And I'm strongly opposed to this bill.
We have several people on the list. I have 6 members that want to talk, but we also have some agencies, I think, that want to make some comments. Would everyone be okay to hold off on questions until we got the agencies, or do you need to, is that okay? So at this time, I will open it up to some agencies for their testimony on this bill, and then after that, we'll resume with questions where I left off on the list. Welcome to the committee, Mr.
Madam
Rakowski.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry, and I just asked to go first because I brought a prop for the committee since we're talking about rules. This is the 2012 International Building Code that we are in the process of adopting rules later this year. It's one of 12 to 15 of these books I've been told that the advisory committees, which are made up of industry, are currently contemplating. Because of a variety of reasons, we have not updated the International Building Code for 6 years. If this bill were to pass, then you'd all have the wonderful chance to go through about 12 of these, and we're a small agency. You're going to hear from bigger agencies in a few minutes. I talked to Representative Wardlow yesterday about the bill a little bit. The mechanics of it are a little disconcerting because the code is expected to be updated and approved and sent to the governor sometime this summer, but the legislature's not in session. And the industry would be kind of in this in-between world of which code should we be adhering to, the 2012 code that is now completed or the one from 6 years ago. And even if they went ahead and started building to the 2012 code, they still stand the chance that when you see this in 2013, you could reject it, and then they'd be out of compliance to the code. Representative Scalzi's licensed with our department, and she brought up the other point, which I hadn't thought of, and that is the number of unlicensed and unregulated work that would be done through in OSHA or in the construction business. So I guess our concern is these rules are put together for safety and health reasons, and not just because we're trying to hurt small businesses. And with that, I'll just leave it and take it over to the department.
Commissioner Beeman, welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Michelle Beeman. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And along with a number of the other agencies, just wanted to convey our strong concern about this bill, both from just a broad policy point of view, as I think indicated in the letter that Governor Dayton sent last session, last year on this, as well as Governor Pawlenty's view. This is a wholesale upending of how our rulemaking and our rule execution of the statutes would be done. I think it would make it logistically impossible for us to keep moving forward on a lot of ways just because of this two-year constant churn and turnover on very technical rules. But I think it also is just it's a shift of power, legislative and executive branch, that needs, if it were to be done, should be very, very, very thoughtfully structured so as not to bring gridlock to what is everybody's goal, both legislatively and in the executive branch, of having people's lives have clear rules, have certainty, have predictability, certainly to move businesses forward. But this would create chaos, in our view. The PCA, as I'm sure you know, as I've mentioned in another bill, we are a delegated agency. We have a lot of federal laws and statutes and requirements that we need to implement on a regular basis. And over the years, we have built up, we don't have 12 volumes like that department, but we have a volume of rules about this thick that have been very carefully done over the years to deal with the intricacies of hazardous waste management, the scientific details of what comes out of air pollution equipment stacks, of what is the interrelationship between pollutants in our water system and aquatic invasives and dioxins. I mean, these are all very technical aspects that, with all due respect, I think go beyond well-meaning technocrats of the people on our staff. We are scientists. We are engineers, people who have dedicated their careers to serving the public in bringing the best science and the best technology and the best approaches for managing very potentially hazardous chemicals and the things that in the laws that this body passes in wanting to protect the citizens, the water and the air and the land. Our agency works very hard to make sure that the rules are carrying out that legislative function, but are doing it with the expertise and the knowledge of people who have been schooled in this work and who come to work every day trying to do that very well. I think on the front end of the bill, which would require that new rules come back before this body, I think the time frame and just the logistics of getting it before session would make it hard where there are rules that would actually help. But it's a little unclear from this dollar threshold. Probably most of our rules would be considered major rules. I mean, we just have that impact across a number of industries with pollution control equipment. We will be in that major rule category. And I think to bottle things up at the front end is very tough. The sunsetting is very tough. I can't imagine how every 2 years, even on a reviewing basis, coming back and having this body, you would have no time for anything else to be able to start looking at whether, you know, 4 parts per billion of dioxin is the right thing to have in our rule, because it does have widespread impact, or whether the liners under landfill should be 4 millimeters or 5 millimeters thick. Those are the details that are in our rules that really the legislature shouldn't be bothered with. You want those engineers and experts to be the ones wrestling with it, and I think to churn that every 2 years would be very, very challenging. And finally, I do think that if the EPA, as a delegated state, if the EPA were to see a structure in place such that our rules would be coming up every 2 years or potentially going away every 2 years, there is the very strong likelihood that they would seek to take the delegation away, because it would be a very unworkable structure in terms of guaranteeing the certainty that the federal pollution control rules are being followed. The practical implication means that then businesses here would be going to the EPA to get their permits. Doesn't mean the regulations go away. It means they're going to Chicago or Washington, D.C., and trying to deal with a bureaucrat, far away in terms of getting their permits. I don't think that's what Minnesota wants. I think we are closest to the businesses here and to the unique circumstances here. And I would challenge and say, in terms of the transparency to the citizens and being accountable and unelected on the side of the executive branch, recall that as part of the Administrative Procedure Act and doing any rule, there is public notice and comment period. There's actually a very structured, defined period where citizens can comment, businesses can comment, and the agency has to put in writing its response. It has to have a statement of need and reasonableness on any rule being passed. That's more, frankly, than a lot of the statutes are passed. I mean, clearly this is a very open process, but things can happen very quickly here. Rules don't happen quickly. They are open for a lot of transparency and input. And there are also procedures within the APA that allow this body, the legislature, to come in and oversee on particular rule topics if there's an area that you've got a concern of, rather than this sort of sweeping overhaul. There's an area you've got a concern about the scope that an agency may be taking or the impact on a certain business. You always have the ability under current law to come in, to put the brakes on something, to add extra requirements in there. And so I do think this is one of those, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater if there are particular concerns in a certain area. But that's the PCA's concern, is we do know that the federal implications of the rules that we have to implement would be very challenging if we had to every 2 years come back to you with water pollution and air pollution and dioxin and asbestos and all of those other technical things that we regulate. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Batsley, will you be, or did you want to respond, Senator Wardlow?
If I may, just briefly.
Okay.
First of all, thank you all for your expertise in public service, and certainly I appreciate, we all appreciate it, and there's nothing in this bill that would prevent an agency from continuing its function. What this bill does is simply provide some legislative oversight in a structural way, in an automatic way, so that the people can understand what their government is doing and have a little light shed on it. And if there are particular issues and particular rules, they can be brought to the public's attention that way. And that's really about it. And we don't need to get into the technicalities of all the different rules, because if it's not necessary, because if a rule is determined to be a major rule, pursuant to procedures that are already, similar to what agencies already do under the APA, the resolution that would be up before the body on any particular rule would simply be to approve the rule or to disapprove of the rule. And then we could debate whatever aspects of the rule we wish to debate or whatever concerns that the public brings to our attention. So we wouldn't be micromanaging the rulemaking process. And also on the separation of powers issue, the problem has been that for decades the non-delegation doctrine has been dead. And there has been over-delegation of legislative authority to the executive branch. So we've been ceding legislative authority to the executive
and agencies have been going beyond the bounds of statutes, either literally beyond the bounds of statutes and enacting rules that don't comply with statutes, or because of sloppy statute writing, we're giving too much authority away that way. But that over-delegation of legislative authority hasn't been pulled back as it has been in times past by the courts. Because that doctrine of non-delegation, it's a separation of power doctrine, separation of powers doctrine is effectively dead in the courts, state and federal. So this is a corrective to that. It restores the separation of powers.
We'll move on to Ms. Batsley, if you want to identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Lynn Batsley, and I'm the legislative liaison at DEED. And I just would like to add a few things. DEED has some concerns on the structure of the bill and DEED's role. And Representative Wardlow called DEED yesterday and talked to our deputy, and they spoke about the concerns that we have. When you look at Section 1, Subdivision 4, those are pretty subjective and burdensome to try and figure out. For example, our department would be challenged to determine the impact on private sector productivity or innovation because of the result of a rule. Impact of prices on customers is also something that we don't have any expertise on. And we don't have any something off the shelf that we could take to look at each of these. We would have to look at each rule individually. And so I think that would mean a fiscal note on this bill. And that's what I wanted to share with you today.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow, can I just see if there's anybody, instead of responding to each one, if there's any other agencies that need to testify? And if not, you can respond quickly, but we do have several questions, so okay. If you could just kind of limit
just
it
very
at this point.
Quick response. I did discuss the bill with Deputy Commissioner Paul Moe at DEED yesterday by telephone, and he indicated that DEED would be able to provide some assistance with certain aspects of making the determination as whether a rule is a major rule in particular, where costs are available, that kind of information. They could do econometric analysis and look at what kind of, for example, employment effects a rule might have. So that's where they would be helpful. The bill does not contemplate that DEED would be making the determinations. The agencies make the determinations. The agencies already make similar determinations under the Administrative Procedures Act, and DEED would just be available to help out as needed and as they are able.
All right. Looks like the folks who want to testify have testified. We'll go back to member questions now. Representative Quam, you were on my list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wardlow. To me, this boils down to two things: legislative intent, and then the continued validity and impact of rules, because we all know as technology and our employment and company base changes, some things that may have been minor in the past present themselves as being more major. And the legislative intent was underlined for me when last week in this very room, a agency was telling us how they were doing the rules and implementation of some legislation that passed last session. And the chair seemed to pipe up a little bit and ask, well, what's the intent that you're working off of here? And they explained some stuff, and the chair said, you know, I was in the committee. I was in the, talking with the governor and the agencies when we came up with a compromise and this was implemented, and that's not at all what the intent that I had and was discussing. So part of this is, making sure legislative intent maintains through the rule process, because we are delegating the implementation of the laws and statutes that we pass. Next is the, there's a debate here about, we're going to have laws and statutes expire with some of the verbiage I heard. The underlying law and statute is not what's coming up to be sunsetted. It is the rules and implementation thereof Therefore, it's not, we're not double-checking our work. We're double-checking the delegated agency activity implementing our work. And I think that oversight, as stated, is appropriate. The interpretation of, you know, that we have this huge code book, and I don't think that we're going through and reviewing international codes, but the interpretation and rulemaking from them, because I have several constituents that have come forward, and that was a great example. Building code, there's nothing in there requiring to have footings underneath non-load-bearing columns. However, a civil engineer, not a structural or mechanical engineer, did some interpretation as implemented rules, which have cost farmers many thousands or tens of thousands of dollars when they're constructing. Now, I am actually, you know, an engineer and a scientist, and I, you know, I've studied, you know, some of these principles, and you've got to have some review of this rulemaking that impacts our economy. To me, I see we're building up, and if we don't have that review, we've got like Jenga, of where you're building a tower and you pull out a piece and you put up here and that. And if we don't go back and verify the validity of these rules, then that tower is going to continue to grow taller, as alluded to, the, you know, how many pages and chapters of rules, and it's going to be unstable. We owe it to our constituents to do due diligence to make sure that the debated and passed legislation is implemented as intended, and that it's kept up to date in that implementation. And that is my input on why we need this. And so I'm going to be supporting this activity because I feel I owe it to the people that elected me.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And you know, I think it's important to have a better understanding and review of the rulemaking process. I mean, rules have the impact of law, and they are often made by unelected people. In a general sense, several times a year I'll have someone come up to me and say something like, what did you guys do in the legislature? This law that you made is, you know, screwing me up in this way or that way. And, you know, as someone who reads every bill from, you know, page, you know, first page to last page, and hangs on every word, sometimes I can't figure out how that could have been. I don't remember passing that law. And then I realize it happened through rulemaking. And so we are being accused of things, of laws that we passed, that actually we realize it happened through rulemaking. And so we are being accused of things, of laws that we passed, that actually were rules made by people who weren't elected. I think that we should, you know, have a good handle on that and how this is happening, what is happening. And we need to know what rules are being brought forth. And I guess one of my, just a question that I would have for someone from an agency, John, maybe you could answer this. How many rules do you change a year?
Mr. Rakusky?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we have, for those who aren't familiar with our statutory obligations, we have OSHA, workers' compensation, wage and hour apprenticeship programs, and finally the construction code and licensing. And I think, and we license about 130,000 businesses and individuals in the state. Rulemaking, I understand from our attorneys, in the area of work comp, we update the medical fee schedules for doctors and pharmacists once a year, every October. So that's essentially ongoing every year. And in the areas of plumbing, high pressure piping, and electrical, that's actually done by advisory boards to the commissioner. Our attorneys serve as counsel to the boards, but the boards are made up of people from the industry. And to answer your question as succinctly as possible, I'd say in one of the four divisions, there's rulemaking going on all the time.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the question becomes, and maybe PCA or someone else can answer too, are we talking a few rule changes a year? Are we talking dozens a year, hundreds? What? Any idea?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I would say fewer than two or three a year from our department. But they're major in scope, and they take the building code process, as I said, it started last year, and so it's about a two-year process for those who have been following that, and that, I said, had been delayed for 6 years. That's probably our biggest one, because it involves so many different advisory committees from industry, literally dozens of people. But I can get you a hard number if you
okay.
Want.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
My point then is, if there are a few or even many, shouldn't it be within the purview of the legislature and legislators to know what they are and be able to have access to that easily?
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of comments I listened to this discussion because it really is a very big policy question on the table, and that's the legislative versus executive power, who delegates what to whom, and what's the impact it has on our citizens. And I'm going to, first, I'll get to the findings comment in just a moment. good catch, Representative Hornstein. But I want to make a rebut a comment that was made. I think Representative Hornstein made it, he sensed the nefarious hands of big business behind this that basically run roughshod over the citizens. And I've got to tell you, I'm thinking of just two anecdotal stories I'll tell you very briefly, neither of which involved a big business. One was a respected small business you'd all recognize if I would use his name. The other involves some neighbors. There is apparently a drainage way that runs through the back of our neighborhood. Didn't know that. Just know that whenever the snow melts, that's usually where it melted last, and that's where it ran. But most of us mow our yards right back to the edge of the brush line and so on and so forth. And one day, people were tramping through our neighborhoods, putting little stakes in the ground, saying, this is some sort of a protected waterway, pretty much all it said. And I'm not saying the words exactly what it said, except I was really annoyed that nobody ever knocked on my door and asked me if they could walk across my yard and put stakes on my lawn, or the church next door, or the neighbors down the street. And then one of the neighbors came over a little later, several weeks later, and said, this note was posted on my front door, because he continued to mow his lawn past that little white stake right to the edge of the brush line where he'd been doing for 30 years. And it told him that he was in violation of the law, he could only mow to that stake, and that if he went past it, he would be fined and dealt with accordingly. He said, what did you do to us? And I said, once again, Representative Erdahl, I don't remember voting on this. I don't know where this came from. But somebody from one of the environmental agencies is out there tramping through the neighborhoods, deciding that something is now off limits that we've been using before with no notification to any of us. And apparently it has to do with some federal waterway rules. Again, it's part of the rulemaking process, and we had no recourse. It just people started showing up. These are private citizens. These aren't big businesses. The other one, I was having lunch with one of my friends who employs several hundred people in the Twin Cities in the construction business. And I was just kind of, this was just before session started, and I wanted to know how things were going. Are you sensing an uptick in the economy, or how are you looking for the year? Because you've weathered a couple pretty tough years. He said, we can deal with the economics. He said, but you know what's scaring the living daylights out of me? The avalanche of regulations, the avalanche of new rules and regulations is going to do us under. And I said, well, what are we doing to you? He said, it's not you guys so much as it's the feds. But he said, you guys have to implement this stuff. And for instance, he told me, he said, they have these little city trucks that run around with pup trailers and the little mobile forklifts for forking bags of cement or cement blocks off the back of their trucks. They've been running them for 30 years again. But he said, I just got a couple of my drivers got pulled over this week The tickets totaled over $300 because he did not have the appropriate flag on this little forklift that he's had on the back of his truck for 30 years. He even called the manufacturer back east and said, what is the signage I'm supposed to have? They hadn't even heard of the rule yet. But somehow our commercial reimbursement division had and was out merrily writing tickets for people who had unapproved equipment with unapproved signs on the back of their trucks. This is another anecdotal example of the avalanche of rulemaking that's happening that goes right past us. And as chair of the Transportation Committee, I got to tell you, I had never heard of this before. I still can't get a straight answer on where this came from, except it's a federal requirement, apparently. So anyhow, is it a good thing, back to the big policy question, that somehow elected officials have some sort of a review and consent process or something like that? I think it is. I think it is. And so I'm very sympathetic with the thrust of the bill and what Representative Wardlow is trying to do with this bill. However, you have the misfortune of this being your first committee, and I'm sure, Madam Chair, this is going to be many more stops, and can you remind us of what the motion is, where it's going next?
Representative Beer, the motion is that this will go to Commerce and Regulatory Reform next.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be a handful of them beyond that. And as you do that, I would advise you to, I'm just going to give you a piece of advice here because I heard this debate at its very conclusion in the Florida legislature 2 years ago. I happened to be in Tallahassee when they called themselves into special session for the purpose of overriding 10 vetoes. This was a Republican House and a Republican Senate, I'll remind you, overriding 10 vetoes by a Republican governor, Charlie Crist. One of them, in fact, I think it was the third one on the docket for the day, was the responsible rulemaking bill that had actually passed bipartisanly, and the governor vetoed it. Now, it's a fun and long political story about why he did this, something to do with the U.S. Senate run and so on. But the point is, the bill had been so thoroughly vetted that out of 120 legislators, it had over 100, I think it was over 105 votes on the veto override, and when it passed the legislature. I don't think it went quite this far, but it had sort of the effect of every rulemaking agency had to submit to every legislative committee, its responsible committee, and legislative committees could pick certain rules and call back for legislative action instead of just letting them become law. Although that rarely happened, they wanted to assert that authority, and so on and so forth. You may want to investigate the Florida model, Representative Wardlow, my suggestion, and figure out, maybe talk to some of the authors, how did they get to bipartisan support for this? How did they get it to such a level that it was overwhelmingly had a veto override? And I'll remember that the hue and cry that caused it had something to do with septic rules and water rules that came out of the agencies that affected just the regular folks. Nothing about big business. It was an avalanche and an outcry from just little people who were being hit broadside with confusing and unanticipated rules that one of the agencies there was making. You may want to check into that story. Last point I'll make before I yield, Madam Chair, and I'm not asking for comment. I'm just saying I'm going to be okay voting to move this to the next committee because this bill has a very big reach, and I think some of that reach needs to be dialed back. I think some of your positions need to be thought through, but you're new, you're enthusiastic, I appreciate that. This needs to be done in some fashion. This could be a vehicle for getting to that fix. When you do a bill, and I've seen a lot of them in the Energy and Environment Committee, usually the findings are the first thing we put in the bill. It's sort of the press release. And if you want to call a press conference and use Section 7 for why you're doing this, that's fine. But usually after the first committee, we like to see those go away. I'm not going to move to strike that at this moment, but I'm sure that someone will in the Commerce Committee, or if you could see fit to do so when you go to the Commerce Committee, the first thing the author should make is the motion to strike Section 7, because I think you've kind of made your point, and that would be appreciated by those of us that enjoy good legislation. Good luck with this, Representative Wardlow.
Thank you. Representative Sanders is next on the list. And then after that, I have Simon Nelson and Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and thank you, Representative Wardlow, for bringing
this discussion for it. I do think it's an important discussion to talk about who cedes how much of what authority, what relationships the legislature has with the executive branch agencies and so on. And like Representative Beard said, I think this obviously does have a long road to go. But members, I think one thing that, at least for me, we need to discuss, and I have an oral amendment to the bill, is, and I've talked this over with Mr. Shepard as well to make sure that it's in order. But in page 6, 6.30 through page 7, line 7.2, and then similarly 7.5 after motion, deleting everything through 7.13. And what this does, members, is in these two sections, it's basically talking about the rules that we abide by on the House floor, but in particular to moving the previous question. I personally don't believe that we should be codifying such language in a state statute or in a bill such as this. I think that those should be items put into our House rules if agreed to by the majority of the body, but that should be where that debate takes place. We do not currently have those rules in the House rules. So, Madam Chair, if it's in order, I would like to offer the oral amendment on line 6.30 after the word motion to delete through line 7.2, and then again on 7.5 after motion to delete through 7.13. And if there's any questions or needs to be read appropriately, Mr. Shepard is prepared to do that as well.
Okay. Representative Sanders moves an oral amendment. Mr. Shepard, could you repeat that oral amendment? And
Madam Chair, questions? I do have this written down for Ms. Hansen, and I will give it to her in a minute. But on page 6, line 30, delete everything after the period, and then delete page 6, line 31, through page 7, line 1. On page 7, line 2, delete the words shall be in order. Page 7, line 5, delete everything after the period, and then on page 7, delete lines 6 to 13.
Does everyone have an understanding of the amendment? Any questions for Mr. Shepard? Representative Sanders, you've explained it, I think. Representative Wardlow, would you like to respond to his?
Very briefly, I take that as a friendly amendment, and it fixes one problem with the bill that needs to be fixed, which is that we shouldn't be putting this into statute. It raises constitutional questions. As you know, the Constitution reserves the right to create rules for each body respectively and its members. I accept this amendment as friendly, and I might add some language in a future stop, perhaps suggesting or requesting the houses to implement rules along these lines or something of that nature. But this addresses a significant issue, and I thank Representative Sanders for making the motion to amend.
Any other discussion to the Sanders oral amendment? Does everyone fully understand it? Then we'll proceed to a vote. All those in favor of the Sanders oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Yes. Amendment does prevail. Back to the bill, and we are back to Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as so often happens when you're down the list, others have ably covered some of the points that I thought I would, but just a couple other notes. I think it's worth remembering that regulations and rules don't just spring up like weeds or flowers, I guess as the case may be, depending on whether you like or don't like the regulation. We tell them to do this. So it comes from us, and I'm not a James Madison scholar, but it seems to me that that would be a faithful and good way to handle this, would just be for us to take more responsibility. It seems to me we already have two tools, at least, to deal with regulations we don't like specifically or generally to deal with a climate of the climate of rulemaking. One is just not to delegate that power in the first place. We don't have to delegate power to agencies to do rules. They only do it when they have legislative authority to do it. And so maybe we need to take greater ownership of what we delegate. That seems to me a very simple, very plausible, very easy way to handle it. And then the second thing, if there's a particular rule or regulation that we disapprove of or if it's the result of agency overreach, we can come back the next session and we can repeal the rule, which we often do. So I worry here that in the presentation somehow a neutral observer watching us might get the impression that there are these rogue agencies creating rules because they feel like it. They don't. They do it because we delegate to them that responsibility and that power. So we just shouldn't do it if we don't want to do it. And if we don't like the result, we should undo it. It seems pretty simple to me. I don't know why do we need this very involved process. You mentioned the words cumbersome, Byzantine, and others before. Certainly the Sanders Amendment was a lot more so, but I think I understand where your intentions are, and you have a strong feeling. I'm sure Section 7 was very fun for you to write. You have a very strong, passionate feeling about the long arm of the state, and that's fine. But I'm not so sure that this is the right process to solve it. I have one other question about kind of the threshold determination here, which is on line 1.18. So as I understand it, under this bill, we wouldn't even get into the discussion of what a major rule is unless the agency that wants to promulgate the rule says it's a major rule under the criteria that you laid out. And I guess what I worry about here, looking forward, not to Governor Dayton, but the governors 20, 40, 60, 100 years from now, don't you think we'll get into some sort of gaming of the system here, and much like, to be honest, we find with fiscal notes. If an administration likes a bill, they say there's no cost to it, or very little. If an administration doesn't, they load it up with all sorts of fiscal costs. That happens year in, year out, doesn't matter the party. Wouldn't the same thing happen here? An agency that really likes a particular regulation will say, this isn't major, this isn't $2 million. Or if it is, it's more than offset by other effects to the economy or other dynamism that it unleashes in other areas, that kind of thing. Aren't you worried that this is just kind of a companion of the fiscal note process where it's subject to the whims of the executive branch?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Simon, for those questions. With regard to your first two points, the tools that we currently have, clearly they're not adequate. The multiplication of rules themselves indicates that something more structural, something broader is needed to rein in rulemaking. Certainly you're correct when you say that we can pass a law that annuls a rule, and certainly you're correct that agencies should only be able to promulgate rules according to what we allow them to do and the intent of statutes that we pass. So, in fact, I have another bill that I'm working on that I haven't put in the hopper yet to address your first point, to tighten up some of the language for agency rulemaking and to kind of cut off some of this at the head of the waters, if you will. But with regard to both points, I don't think that that's adequate because there, as we've heard anecdotally from around the table today and as I've heard from constituents, there's a problem with excessive delegation of legislative authority, and it's not necessarily because we have intentionally delegated it. It may be because agencies have gone a little bit beyond the ambit of the particular delegations, and there's no mechanism right now to draw that back, pull that back in, except by, like you pointed out, passing a law to nullify basically a rule. But that doesn't happen very often around here. So this will just bring some accountability to the system and force us to look at rules that hit a certain threshold that hurt businesses and families and Minnesotans and make sure there's some accountability. Now, with regard to your second question, whether agencies will take the classification of a rule as a major rule or non-major rule seriously, basically, is your question. Your point, your thought, is a very legitimate one, and I was also concerned about that very point, that an agency would, and a future governor, this one, future governors, looking down the road 100 years, would simply classify a rule as a non-major rule because it suited them. Well, that's why the judicial review portion of the bill is in the bill, and that's why the Office of Administrative Hearings is given the ability to review upon a petition by any person agreed by the rule, whether a classification of a rule as a non-major rule, but not as a major rule, just if an agency classifies a rule as non-major, as not having a major economic impact. That's challengeable, and if the classification was made in bad faith or arbitrary and capriciously or not based on substantial evidence, then the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Administrative Law Judge, can order the rule null and void, and that same rule cannot be brought up in the same biennium, so there's a consequence there. But, of course, a more narrowly tailored rule could be brought up. So that will encourage agencies to make sure that they're taking the classification seriously, and they won't be able to just classify a rule as non-major because it suits them. So I appreciate that concern, and I think the bill addresses it.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left of committee. Perhaps we can go to Representative Winkler, and then I just have Nelson on the list, and then we can decide if we want to vote or come back tonight or what we want to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that very subtle threat.
that was not a threat. I was just leaving it open to discussion.
I see. Representative Wardlow, the concern, I guess, is in part that agencies are issuing rules without adequate consideration for things like Representative Beard talked about, which would be notice, ability of regulated parties to implement them in a cost-effective manner, whether or not the rules are necessary, whether they're duplicative, whether they are really achieving the purpose set out in the law in the first place. And I think those are all legitimate concerns to raise about any rule or any rulemaking process. But I have to wonder what James Madison would think of our seriousness as legislators about passing a bill, moving it on, and working on it later on the fly with such far-reaching implications and really doing a pretty shoddy job of legislating ourselves when we're complaining about shoddy rulemaking. The anecdotal stories are part of what we actually do as legislators. We hear stories. We respond to constituents. If there are concerns, we try to pass laws that fix them, or we weigh in with agencies to try to get a little bit of relief for people. That's part of the feedback loop of lawmaking that involves the agencies, involves the legislature involves the public. And, you know, this looks more like a talking points kind of bill rather than a real bill to me. It reminds me a bit of the Sunset Commission, whose most recent report didn't have any sunsets in it. It made great talking points, but they looked at all the agencies and decided to do nothing. And I'm sure everyone's time was well spent in deciding that they should do nothing. But essentially that's what the last Sunset Commission talking point bill reform that this body passed amounted to. I think, as in many regards, the legislature should actually work on fixing its own house before it blames others. And Representative Erdahl, if you think we need to review rules, ask the chair. We do oversight. I'm sure the chair would be more than happy to actually get an understanding of how many rules are passed and whether the process works, whether there's duplication and notice. All those things actually take work, and they're not as easy as a press release or as a statement of findings about James Madison. They actually take hard work. So I think in the spirit of doing some hard work, we should not move this bill on, and I would move that we lay this bill on the table and request a roll call.
Okay. Representative Winkler has moved that we lay this bill on the table. Is that your motion?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ask for a roll call?
Yes.
A roll call being requested. There will be a roll call on the Winkler motion. The clerk will take a roll.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Okay, there being 6 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail and the motion is not adopted. Back to the bill. Did you have additional questions, Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, just one final comment. I know that the National Federation of Independent Business and the National Chamber of Commerce for several years now have been complaining about uncertainty, regulatory uncertainty, as one of the things that's holding back the economy. And it's curious that on lines 8.27, 8.28, you are eliminating the rules every 2 years, and I can't think of anything that's going to cause more uncertainty then the possibility that every rule that a business operates by has to change every 2 years. And I guess I would just question the sincerity of the statement that this is a bill to actually help businesses. It's either one or the other. Either regulatory uncertainty is a problem for business, or it's not. But if you're just doing it in order to have less regulation, you should just say that.
A brief answer, Representative Wardlow?
Yes, very briefly, just to clarify, looking at that section, the sunset section, it does not kill all rules every 2 years. What it does is it requires that the agencies look at the rules, submit reports as to whether they're major or non-major, and then if they're non-major, like I said before, they continue along, no change. If they're major, the legislature gets to take a look, and there shouldn't be any change. The judicial review mechanism of the classification is intended to make sure that rules that are close to the statutory intent, and the entire process will result in more certainty because rules will either not have major economic impacts and will be more narrowly tailored that way, or that if there will be, or there will be significant policy rules that the legislature should take a look at every at periodically, and but nothing is automatically repealed by this bill.
Representative Winkler, do you need that clarify things for you?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to risk your wrath of having to eat my dinner here in committee to talk about this bill any further. But I just say that they do expire unless the legislature reauthorizes them.
The major bills, not all
major
bills. I just want to throw that for everyone. Representative Nelson, you were the last one I had on my list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Representative Simon said a lot of what I had to say, but another point came up. You know, we've talked here that other a bill or other places they can get rid of them. It's been shown that we can do that. If people have unreasonable rules that they think are there, they can come to legislatures. We can put in legislation and redo these rules or eliminate these rules now. So I think this is just going way too far. But the subtle suggestion that the chair made about carrying this on or having coming back later tonight and doing it is an example of why in my earlier testimony I talked about we're going to be burdening the legislature with a lot more stuff to do, and with limited time that we have in current statute of the number of days we can meet, we're going to be spending a lot of time doing this. Otherwise, we're going to be running out of time in committee like we, and the subtle reminder that was earlier in previous committees where we've been keep reminding that subtly that we have other bills to do, we don't have enough time to do this. The time that we have in the legislature is limited, and this is putting a lot more burden on the legislature to do all the rules as opposed to right now. We can currently go back if rules are bad or rules that have causing a problem, we can put a bill through to get rid of those rules. And I think this just is, this again is a way of huge expansion of what we should be doing.
Okay, that was the last member I had on the list. Is there any other questions? Okay, seeing no other questions, I will renew my motion that House File 1831 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. A roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call, and clerk will take the roll.
Representative Pepin.
Aye.
Representative Murray.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hancock.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative McFarland.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Erdahl.
Aye.
Representative Sanders.
Yes.
Representative Scalzi.
No.
Representative Winkler.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail and the bill is adopted. Good work there. Just before we go, I just wanted to, not to end on a sad note, but I wanted to let you all know that Representative O'Driscoll lost his father last night to a battle with cancer. And so please keep him in your thoughts and prayers. And without seeing any other housekeeping business, we will adjourn tomorrow morning.